This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. When I say that, I mean people who are willing to put their lives on the line for our freedom. And we certainly are educated, we're entertained, we're inspired each week by these stories from our greatest generation. I know it's going to be no different today with 91-year-old Leon Christensen of Clovis, California. Grew up a little ways away from there in the small farm town of Easton. And you grew up with three brothers and two sisters. That's Danish heritage. How many generations had your family been here?
Three, I guess. My grandfather came first, and then all his kids. And then my dad came over when he was 20 years old, joined the Army, very patriotic man. And his brothers followed him, and pretty soon we had a lot of Christensens here.
I guess so. And a lot of those Danish immigrants were dairy folks. The Danish creamery was a big business around here. Did you ever have to milk any cows growing up?
Oh, boy. I lived on a farm big part of my life, and that was one of my jobs, milking the cow.
How early would you have to get up to do that?
Well, of course, we were going to school, so I had to get up pretty early. Oh, probably around 5 o'clock in the morning.
What do you remember about your childhood as far as what kind of ambitions or dreams that you had?
Well, my dad was a violin player, and he taught me to love music. And so I thought someday I would probably be a virtuoso violin player. Didn't happen, but I did enjoy my music.
Didn't happen yet. You're still working on it, aren't you?
You're still working on it, yeah.
How old were you when you started with the violin?
I was in grammar school, so probably in about the sixth grade.
And you, now all these years later, you've actually made violins?
I've made two violins,
That's got to be a painstaking process.
It is. You have to have a lot of patience. I always wanted to make a violin. I tried making them out of cigar boxes and every way. I wanted to make my own violin. One day, I was fairly young. I was probably around 25 or 26 years old. I was driving by a violin maker officer home here in town, Stanley Keith, violin maker. And just on a hunch, I just pulled over and went in and talked to him and told him my ambition was to make a violin. He said, well, if you're serious, give me $10 and I'll order you a book of the art of violin making. And in fact, if you read this book, if you still want to make a violin, he didn't think I would. And he says, I'll do everything I can to help you.
He didn't know what a glutton for punishment you were, I guess, huh?
I got the book, and in the book, I read it through. I had no idea what was involved in making a violin. But I went back to him and said, I want to try. He helped me. I made my own tools, my own little planes, tempered the steel and all of that, made my little planes and scrapers, because it's carved out of solid wood.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. And each step I would come and see him, and he'd help me with it on my first violin. And it turned out pretty good. It took me quite a while, but it turned out pretty good. But I wasn't satisfied with it. And so I decided to make another one. And that was in 1953. That's the violin I have here now. I made in 1953, so that's, 60 years old?
Yeah, and, you know, everyone's hearing you talk about the violin. I know they want to hear you play the violin. So before we're done, I'm going to have to get you to at least humor us a little bit. But music's been good to you. Maybe some of our listeners in the Fresno area have heard you play that violin in people's church over the years, and music's what introduced you to your wife. So I know it was pretty good to you. And it's a big part of your military story, too. But you would have never had a chance to make those violins if you didn't survive World War II, and in particular, June 6th of 1944, which we're going to talk about. But let me ask you first about a different date that everyone seems to remember. December 7th, 1941. You're in your senior year at Clovis High School.
Yes.
How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked?
We were on our way home from church. Dad had the radio on. So I was in the automobile going home from church when I heard we'd been attacked at Pearl Harbor.
What did that mean to you? Could you even grasp what that meant?
Well, I just couldn't imagine a little country like Japan would attack a country like ours. But, you know, I was still just a kid, and I didn't think of the seriousness of it, I guess, too much. But it amazed me that Japan would attack the United States.
And when did it hit you that this might be something you were going to have to become involved with?
I forget when they started the draft, but I had to go down and register for the draft. And I went ahead and graduated, and I was 18. And the following October, my number got real close, and I wanted to choose the service I would go in. And so, and with my dad's encouragement, we selected the Navy, and I joined the Navy.
And did your dad tell you to try the Navy because he knew what the Army was like?
Yes.
Do you remember what he told you? Was there something he didn't want you to see?
Well, my dad never went into action. He never left the country, actually. But he knew what the Army was like, and he says, you don't want to be in those foxholes. He says, in the Navy, if you could join the Navy, well, you get a shower every day and a meal every day, and which is true. So that's how we decided to choose the Navy. And I was going to do that anyway, but my dad's encouragement was wonderful.
Little did you know what you would end up experiencing, but it sounds like at least the first part of your time in the Navy was quite the adventure for you. You had some nice duty stations and some fun things to do.
I did. While I was in boot camp, they asked all of us if we wanted to apply for school in some field, you know, engineering or whatever. And I said I would like to go to the Fleet School of Music because that was really the only thing I was any good at, if you call it good. I was accepted to the Fleet School of Music in San Diego. I went there for 8 months, and they trained me and made me a better musician. And also, they trained me in the medical field where I could assist doctors and corpsmen in their duties, taking care of people that needed help. Being a musician was what I was. I was a petty officer, had the little lyre on my badge and everything. I was very happy to be able to go to the school and get this training. And then, of course, that came to an end, and I got assigned.
Did you ever have the opportunity to perform for VIPs or dignitaries?
No, but I marched in lots of parades.
I bet you did. But you don't see too many violin players marching in the band.
No. In fact, I got my appointment to music school through my violin playing. My trumpet playing wasn't that great. I played high school trumpet and played in the band in high school. But when I auditioned for that, they weren't that impressed. They said, do you have any other music background? I said, my instrument is really the violin. That's what I've been trained on. And he says, do you have your violin here? And I said, no, but I can get it. My dad sent it to me, and I auditioned on the violin. They accepted me.
Uh-huh.
They said they could teach me to play the trumpet better.
But they knew you had musical acumen.
Yeah.
Have you ever wondered how things would have been different if you didn't have that second chance with the violin?
I had no idea what would have happened. I probably would have been assigned to a ship somewhere.
But you did go through the Fleet School of Music, and then they sent you to a nice tropical destination.
Right. I got assigned to Balboa, which is the American settlement on the Panama Canal. And it had a nice band down there, which I joined. It was a paradise because all we had to do was have a rehearsal every morning. We played one concert a week, and then one of the trumpet players would play taps or reveille for the bass over the loudspeaker. And basically, that's all I had to do. And they had a beautiful golf course there and beautiful tennis courts, and I was both a golfer and tennis player. Tennis is really my sport. So I had a really nice year, like belonging to a country club almost. It all came to an end after a year.
During that time, and obviously you got a lot out of it, it was a great place to be. You got to play music, you got to play golf and tennis. Did you find some satisfaction in your opportunities to entertain other troops, that you were using your talents to do something for them?
I enjoyed that very much.
They probably enjoyed it too.
Well, I hope so.
Did you guys have a lot of dances and stuff that play for?
The band had a dance band within the band, and I was in that.
You also mentioned guys playing taps and reveille. Is that something that you had to be part of?
Maybe once a week I would have to do it.
Did you play it on a trumpet or a bugle?
On a trumpet.
Well, I'll come back to that later once you get on your ship. How was it that you found out you're going to be assigned to this historic World War I era battleship, the USS Texas?
Yeah. Well, I got my orders to report for duty on the battleship Texas. And I got a 30-day leave, so I went home and had my 30 days, and I caught my ship in New York. So I had to go back on a cattle train. The trains were terrible. They used for servicemen. They were awful. I'll never forget when I walked on that ship. how big that thing was, you know, and all those big guns on there. It was really an experience.
If you can remember, what do you think your mindset was preparing to become part of this big ship that obviously is built for a purpose and that you're going to be part of this purpose?
Well, I knew that we were going to go to war, for one thing, but they don't tell us in advance. Our ship took off from New York for England, and I was one of those poor souls that got seasick.
Uh-oh.
And I got real sick, but I only lasted for a couple of days, and I was okay. Before we went to England, we went across the Atlantic and down through the Straits of Gibraltar into the Mediterranean Sea. And we were there for the end of the war in North Africa. I got to go ashore in Italy there. But we didn't really have to do hardly anything there because it was almost over that we were there for in case we were needed. Then we came back through the Straits and went up to England. And we went on the west side of the British Isles. We did a lot of maneuvering and training. And we knew through rumors that something big was going to happen and that we were going to be part of it. But we didn't know much. They didn't tell us much.
Well, there was somebody whose job it was to tell people stuff as well that ended up on your ship. Were you on the Texas when this young guy named Walter Cronkite came aboard?
Yes, but I didn't get to meet him or anything. Eisenhower came on our ship to tell us what we were going to do and before we took off for Normandy.
Yeah, I've seen some photos of that, of Eisenhower on the Texas addressing all the sailors. What do you remember about that? That to me seems like it was probably a little bit of a goosebump moment or an adrenaline builder.
Yes, it was, I guess. Of course, here I'm just a kid.
Yeah.
19 years old probably then. And I wasn't too serious about anything. I thought it was wonderful. I got to see Eisenhower. I'd heard so much about him as a general. But I remember one thing he said about this invasion, that if our ship was hit and would not be able to maneuver anymore, we were going to beach it. And that scared the pants off of me.
Yeah.
Because we'd beach it and fight from the ship, I guess. But I listened to his whole talk to us. And, of course, I was just a peon. I didn't get to meet him or anything. But it was an experience.
But that prospect stuck with you.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, here you are on the ship as a musician, and then when the battle's raging, you're helping out the medical staff.
Right.
You'd had no designs of charging ashore and taking on the Germans in hand-to-hand combat.
No way.
So, June 6th, the Texas got into action pretty early that day, huh?
Yes. I remember we traveled all night that night to the coast of France, off the coast of France, Normandy. You can't believe the armada of ships that was out there. You could almost feel like you could step from one ship to another. There's so many ships out there. Of course, you couldn't, but it was quite an experience to wake up. It was still dark, and I could hear airplanes above. They were already bombing, and it wasn't long before we were firing our cannons, making a beachhead for our soldiers to land.
Yeah, you guys were right off of a real famous spot at Omaha Beach, the Point du Hoc, where the Rangers famously scaled those cliffs. But you guys were shelling that position atop those cliffs.
That's right.
And where were you while all this is going on?
I'm on the ship, and we're out just off the coast of Normandy.
Did you have a specific duty station? Were you standing to tend to wounded?
Oh, yes.
Where was your duty station?
With the medical department, and if we got a call, we'd answer that call.
Mm-hmm. Had you ever heard anything like what you were hearing in that moment?
Never.
With all those guns firing?
Never, never.
And I know you're a musician, so you have a finely tuned ear. Can you help us understand what that sounded like?
It's hard to explain, but it was so noisy because there's other big ships firing just like we were, and cruisers and aircraft carriers. In a way, it was kind of exciting because I couldn't see that we were getting any response from the shore at all. Except buzz bombs. We could hear those buzz bombs. And I don't know if you've ever heard of buzz bombs or not, but they didn't have anything that was radio controlled or anything. But they had these bombs that had a motor on them that would carry them out so far and then they'd drop.
Mm-hmm.
And England was experiencing, they almost destroyed London, I guess, with these from across the channel.
Right.
And we could hear them and we could hear some explosions, but none came close to our ship. And we came through unscathed. We didn't even get bombed by airplanes, really, because our airplanes were protecting us above us. as well as bombing the beachhead.
As I understand it, the firing started a little before 6 a.m. Yeah. You guys are pounding this beach. And hours later, around noontime, there's this growing concern that, hey, there's more Germans over there than we thought. And the Texas actually went closer to shore to fire the guns.
Well, we were called up to the beachhead had been established. The troops were in, and there was no need for us to be there with our big guns because we couldn't fire. They were so far in, we couldn't fire over them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But they had the Germans trapped out on a peninsula called Cherbourg.
Right.
So they sent a few ships, of which ours was one, were sent up to 10, 12 miles off the coast of Cherbourg, and we started firing on their situation there. We had two planes on our ship that we catapulted off. They were sightseeing planes. They weren't armed or anything. And spotter planes is what we used them for. We sent them up, and they kind of looked at what the situation was, and they thought that it was secured. We've been bombarding for quite a while. But so they sent us in pretty close. We went in within, I don't know the exact distance, but I would imagine within 6 or 8 miles of shore. And then all of a sudden, the Germans all came to life. I was sitting on the deck at the time. I went up on top. All of a sudden, we heard these splashes in the water, and we knew we were being shelled. So we got to our battle station. They sounded battle stations call. We all went to our battle stations.
And we're going to leave you right there for the moment. 91-year-old Leon Christensen of Clovis, California is our guest today. He served on the battleship USS Texas during World War II. That violin he mentioned, here's a little taste of it as we head to break. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you want to see some photos of today's guest, Leon Christensen, pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. You'll even find a photo of this Navy musician carrying a wounded soldier on a stretcher. That photo appeared in the Saturday Evening Post, among other publications. It was taken during the Battle of Cherbourg, June 25th, 1944, which is what we were just getting into when we left off. So you said shells started hitting the water. That's what triggered general quarters. And pretty soon those shells were hitting your ship.
We took two hits, one on the conning tower, which we lost a man there, and wounded several. Conning tower, in case you wonder or don't know, is the main tower that goes up on the ship, and decks are built around it. The shell hit just below one of the decks, and my friend, his name was Christensen, got killed on that one. And then a while later, we took another shell, went through the hull of our ship, and landed in a compartment right close to where I was. We didn't know about it, and it didn't explode.
Mm-hmm.
It was a dud. Had it exploded, I probably wouldn't be talking to you today.
Yeah. And in fact, you can see that unexploded shell, and I think maybe your son did when he visited the USS Texas. Mm-hmm. It's on display. Where else but the Lone Star State? Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this. Just to clarify for people, this is a couple weeks after D-Day, almost 3 weeks after. And while I mentioned D-Day, so much has been written about June 6th. And there were so many elements of it. You've got the planes overhead, the paratroopers and gliders behind enemy lines, the guys who were hitting the shore, and obviously all of you on over 700 ships between the Americans and the British that morning. But the moniker that has stuck is The Longest Day.
Mm-hmm.
Did it feel that way to you?
Oh, yeah, I guess it did in a way. Again, I'm just a young kid yet. I didn't take anything as serious as an older person might have. I wasn't scared.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't scared. I don't know how to explain how I felt.
But on that day, there wasn't a whole lot of damage on your ship.
No.
But here you are, no damage, which is pretty incredible considering where you were and what was going on. But here you get a couple weeks later at Cherbourg, and the Germans are hitting your ship. And you mentioned that the first casualty, the first to die on your ship, was named Christensen, mm-hmm. Kristen Christensen.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually knew him? You
guys, very well, yes.
Because of the common surname? Is that what brought you together?
No, I could be.
Yeah?
Could be. We met each other. We weren't close buddies or anything, but acquaintances.
Well, and so often I talk to veterans, and they all have moments where, you know, it could have been me. Maybe I wouldn't have come home, and you just described them for me. But it seems to me that when one of the guys on your ship dies, it's a friend of yours, and he has the same name as you, how do you not feel like that could have been me?
It really hurt. Uh-huh.
Was there anything that helped you deal with that?
Well, as working with the corpsman, I had to go up and help get him down and a couple of the wounded from this deck that had been blown up. So the shell hit just below and it exploded up, you know, and it snapped his legs off, bled to death. He got taken down, but he never recovered. But the feeling was terrible to see a friend like that. But it would have been the same, I think, for anybody to see one of your buddies go down.
Well, and I've got to imagine you've never experienced anything like this. I mean, you've done dirty jobs on the dairy, but coming face to face with this kind of carnage.
Yep, that's right. It was really an experience.
How'd you deal with that? How did you keep evacuating the wounded and carrying on with your tasks in the midst of that?
Well, it's just something that we knew we had to do. And I think it's a frame of mind. I saw guys that were, you know, that I thought were real tough sailors and actually break down under fire, especially at Cherbourg when we got hit and lost it, you know. And some way I was able to be calm about it. And when I saw those shells splashing in the water and then they sound GQ, which is get to general quarters right away, I think I was fairly calm about it. To say I wasn't scared, I guess I was afraid a little bit, but not too much. It's just something we knew we had to do.
And I read one account that said that there were about 65 near misses.
Yes.
Shells that almost hit the Texas.
Almost hit us. We only got hit by two.
And then there's the one that didn't explode.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you want to talk about a close call, this is a 240-millimeter shell.
Yes.
That's a big sucker. And you said that the room where it was found was close to where you had
been?
Yes,
very close. Almost in the next, almost as I remember the layout there in the next compartment down from where we were.
And you were in there when it hit?
Yeah. That's where I was, waiting to be called. Because I didn't know when it hit because it was a dud and it didn't go off. And I didn't make that much. But it hit above the water line. So it didn't, no water came in the ship.
No one even knew it was there until later.
No, later.
Yeah.
No.
That's got to be quite the realization when you see
that. Yes. And I got called up to help on the deck up above with my friend Christensen and a few others that got wounded.
When this exchange is finally over, when the firing finally stops, were you still busy with caring for wounded? What were you doing?
I was working with the meds on that as long as I could. And then they got transferred off our ship. And I don't know what happened to the man that I carried down. I know that he's was badly hurt in his eye area. He's had his hands in his eyes like this, and he was unconscious. He was a ranger.
And you had to carry him to be transferred to?
They brought him out in a small boat to alongside our ship. There were several, but we brought out a couple, three or four maybe. And I got this one, and we carried him down to what we call sick bay on the ship, but it was our hospital down there. That probably affected me a lot because I thought, here he is, he's unconscious, he can't talk, but he has his hands over his eyes like this. I didn't know whether he had his eyes hit or what, but we delivered him down and came back up. I don't know how many were brought on, but I know that the one that I carried was a ranger.
So you're carrying all this out, and you're carrying this wounded man. I'm sure there's all kinds of emotions running through your brain, but you just have to keep going and keep working. When did you find out that this image of you carrying a wounded ranger on your ship in June of 44 was in the Saturday Evening Post for the whole country to see?
I didn't know until the doctor, the head doctor on our ship, told me. And he's the one that always told me every time I went into battle after that, that you look my photogenic best. You've been making fun of me, of course. But that's when I found out, probably a few days later, he said that my picture was in the Saturday Evening Post, and my parents got the picture too. I think it was even present in the Fresno Bee. Anyway, my parents knew about it. So that's an experience to have your picture put in a magazine like that. They didn't mention my name in the picture.
Sure. When you look at it now, what does it make you think
of? Memories, lots of memories, Paul. You know, this happened over 70 years ago. It's just hard to believe that 70 years have passed since then. It's just, you know, as I get older, I think more about it than I did when I was young. I didn't even want to talk about it that much. But now these memories are all very vivid. As if I was just there right now. It's a feeling that you never forget, I guess.
And your Navy experience was far from over there. But while we're on that topic of 70 years later, all these things becoming fresh for you, one of the recent experiences you had was to visit the National World War II Memorial and other sites in Washington,
yes,
D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Did that provide you opportunities to reflect on your friend Christensen or the ranger that you're carrying in that famous photo?
Yes, it did. It brought back a lot of memories to see the World War II Memorial there with thousands of stars on it. And each star represented people who had lost their lives in the war. I thought of the magnitude of that and how many men gave their lives. Quite a feeling, yes. And also, when I visited the other memorials, I felt the same way at the Vietnam Memorial and at the Korean Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just can't help but think about all the men. You know, you just can't help but think about all the men that sacrificed their life. And here I am, all right, you know.
In remarkable shape at 91 and still playing your violin.
In my Sunday school class, adult Sunday school class, as a man that was a guardian on the flight before the one I went on.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and he knew my story. He said, I want to give you an application. And I got accepted right away, and I went on the next flight. And that was a wonderful experience. So many people came out to the airport because it was advertised very heavily. And women were coming out of the crowd to kiss us. And, this was quite an experience.
What was the most meaningful part of that experience for you?
The high point of that whole trip for me, and it was an exciting trip all the way around, was to meet men that I fought alongside of and didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Sit and eat with them at dinner time. I remember one man said, you know, when we were even in Iwo Jima, our ship was a destroyer. I was on a destroyer. It eventually got hit by a kamikaze, lost the ship, but he survived. But talking about the battle for Iwo Jima, knowing that we were just side by side there, that close,
mm-hmm,
and never knew each other. And then another one that was with me on a ship, it was real close to our ship and knew the Texas well, at Normandy, the invasion of Normandy. Just to be able to be with the guys that were that close to me was the high point of my trip. It was wonderful to be able to meet with people that were all up in their upper 80s or lower 90s and reminisce about the war. And there were 70 of us,
mm-hmm,
plus the guardians. There were 70 guardians. Each vet had to have a guardian.
Mm-hmm.
We could not be out of his sight 1 minute.
Nope. You get a lot of demerits for that. Well, I know I'm bouncing around here, but let's go back to the Texas. So you survived that Cherbourg mission. And now I'm curious, because you mentioned that you did know that first sailor on your ship who was killed, mm-hmm, Christensen. How did you guys memorialize him on the ship? Did you have a service for him with a flag-draped coffin and all
yes,
that?
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. And they did taps. But I don't think he was buried at sea. I think they took him off the ship and he was returned to his family. Lots of people that died on a ship were buried at sea.
Yeah. I was wondering if you ever had to perform taps at a moment
no,
like that.
No, I didn't.
You think you could have done it?
I think I probably could have. Wouldn't have been easy, but I probably could have.
Mm-hmm. And your ship wasn't done yet. You alluded to some of the spots that you would end up in the Pacific.
After that was secured there in France, we took our ship across to Plymouth, England, across the channel, and got minor repairs that would get us safely back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I got a 30-day leave, so I went home for a month and came back to my ship. It was in the Brooklyn Navy Yards and been repaired, and went aboard my ship, but I didn't know where we were going until a few days later. We went back down through the canal to the West Coast, and we went right by my barracks when I was stationed down in Panama. I was right on the canal bank. And I went by, saw my old barracks there. It was quite a feeling.
And you guys headed to Iwo Jima, and you were there shelling before the Marines hit the beaches.
Yes.
And here you had been, if there's two signature moments for forces hitting beaches in World War II, it's Omaha Beach on June 6th of 44 and Iwo Jima on February 19th.
That was terrible.
Worse than what you saw on D-Day.
Yeah, because I didn't actually see the troops landing. There's so much stuff in front of us that I just, you couldn't see them. But at Iwo Jima, we bombarded for 72 hours before I sent our troops in. And I remember I had binoculars and I was watching the landing. That really hurt to see our Marines go down and be mowed down. We thought we had it pretty safe for them to land, and they were all buried in, dug in, and we lost thousands and thousands of men. And it was a terrible thing.
And maybe people don't realize that, but you just mentioned it. You were shelling for 3 days before they went in, and this is not that big of an island. So you guys had to believe you'd done a lot of damage.
Yeah, we thought we had.
But you didn't know those tunnels and all the
holes and buried there, but they sure came out. And a lot of the men I saw through the binoculars, we were out maybe a mile off the shore, if that far. Close enough that I could see the men landing. Some of them never made it to the beach. They were shot in the water and then mowed down when they got on the beach. But we took it. We took the beach. A big sacrifice. I've always had a soft heart for the Marine. They were wonderful fighters.
And as Admiral Nimitz famously said, for those Marines in World War II, uncommon valor was a common virtue. More than 6,800 Americans died in that battle at Iwo Jima. Time for another break, but when we come back, the eye-opening conversation Leon had with his mother when he came home on leave. Coincidence or divine intervention? You can decide when Leon shares that amazing twist as we hear a little more of his 91-year-old fingers on that homemade violin. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping things up with 91-year-old Leon Christensen of Clovis, California. We're going to hear briefly from his son and grandson before we're done, but let's pick up where we left off with your ship, the battleship USS Texas, when you finished your duties at Iwo Jima.
After we were through there, we went to Okinawa and helped establish a beachhead for our soldiers to land there. And that was the Army then. There was strictly Marines on the first assault on Iwo Jima.
Right.
But the Army, I think, was what landed on Okinawa.
Now, you made reference earlier when we were talking about Cherbourg and how your ship was hit there. You said you didn't really remember being scared.
No, I don't. I remember other people being scared.
Sure.
But I didn't, to me, and I think it's because I was so young, I didn't realize what was happening as much as some of the older fellows.
I wonder, too, because you've described your church, long involvement at People's Church, and you mentioned the Sunday school class you're still a part of. Was your faith something that helped you during this time?
You know, I was brought up in a Christian home, a very devout Christian home, where we had family worship every morning before we went to school. After the chores were done, we'd come in and have a family worship. We'd sing some hymns and pray. Dad would read a piece in the Bible. I had all this upbringing, but I never had made a decision for myself. I couldn't call myself a real Christian at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But because of my upbringing, I believed in God, and I knew I had people back home praying for me. And all of this was a comfort to me. It's a, A strange thing, Paul, after I got home on leave between the European campaign and the Pacific campaign, I was home for 30 days. First thing my mother asked me what I was doing on the morning that we were bombarding Cherbourg. I told her that we were, on this particular morning, what were you doing? And I said, we were bombarding Cherbourg, and that's where we got hit. She says, you know, I had a, on that morning, she said, I had a strange feeling that you needed prayer, so I prayed for you. And I always like to think that God intervened through my mother's prayer.
So she, without knowing where you were, threw out a date.
Yeah.
June
just
25th.
A feeling that she had that I needed prayer.
You know, that's, you're about the third or fourth veteran who's told me a very similar story to that.
All right.
That their mother was stirred to pray.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that amazing? And this is the day where that unexploded shell was found in a compartment next to yours.
That's right.
Connect the dots, huh?
Well, think what you want, but it could be God's hand.
Is that what you think?
I think it very well could be.
So you're in Europe, you're in the Pacific, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and you're on your way home when you hear of the first atomic bomb?
Yes, we were probably a few days out of San Francisco. I was home when they dropped the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big, big night. Everybody was downtown celebrating in Fresno, and the war was over.
VJ Day, you're talking about. So
VJ Day.
In August of 45, you were back in Fresno.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people listening in Fresno now are curious what Fresno was like on that night.
Wild.
Yeah?
Yeah.
People running out in the streets or what?
Oh, yes. Navy was exchanging uniforms with the Army and so on, doing crazy things. A lot of drinking and a lot of drunkenness, but it was a big celebration.
Was it a relief to you?
That the war was over? Yes.
Because you hadn't been discharged.
No. I had my leave. That's when I fell in love with my would-be wife.
Yeah, let's hear that story. So here you're a musician. You'd played your violin in church, and any time you did, you had the same accompanist on the piano?
Yes, I did.
And her name was Roxy.
Roxy.
And you thought the world of her, but she had a boyfriend.
That was the problem. She had he was a soldier, a lieutenant in the Army.
Uh-huh.
And I knew him very well. They were always to church together, and we just thought that was a deal. My aunt told me that, maybe it isn't as close a deal as you think. Maybe you can go double dating, which we did. We went out and played miniature golf. I called her, and she accepted my invitation. I think we fell in love on that first night. Even though I'd been with her many times, I just didn't think of her because I thought she was taken.
Right.
And it was a wonderful evening we had, and we got something to eat after we played. And I saw her every night after that.
Every night of your leave?
Every night of my leave.
So it was music that brought you together?
Yes. She was such a talented person. Artists would come to town and request that she accompany them. Might be at our church, it might be at somebody else's church, but she was that kind of a musician.
Well, it's just a guess, but I'd guess that your four children and your six grandchildren are glad your aunt encouraged you to pursue Roxy.
I hope so. I'm sure they are.
And I know they're thankful that you survived World War II through all those close calls. When you think back on it now, what grabs you the most or amazes you the most about what you experienced and how you survived it all?
Well, boy, that's a tough one, Paul. I think the time I was the most scared was off the coast of Iwo Jima on the kamikaze planes. You see, we were a large armada of ships there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the big ships, like the battleships and the carriers, in the middle, and all the other ships around were destroyer escorts, and they were the ones that were responsible for keeping our big ships safe and shooting down the planes as they would come in. And I remember a bunch of kamikaze planes. They lined up one behind the other, line, and one would get in so far, and they'd shoot them down, and the next one get a little farther, and finally they sometimes get to their target. And we had a very close call. A plane almost got to us.
Somebody shot it down?
Mm-hmm. But they're loaded with explosives, and they could cause a lot of damage. And a lot of ships went down from these kamikaze planes. That sticks out in my mind very vividly. Another thing that sticks out in my mind that I'll never forget is the armada of ships that I saw off the coast of Normandy, Omaha Beach. I never, ever thought I'd see that many ships.
And pretty staggering, huh?
Yes, it is.
Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that nobody else could tell. You know, and I've interviewed a lot of veterans who served in the Pacific and encountered the Japanese, and some of them still have a problem with any Japanese-made cars. But I know that wasn't an issue for you, because maybe some people listening remember hearing your voice on the Kloss and Honda commercials when you were the general manager there saying, give me your tagline.
You'll be impressed.
I think they've heard that voice before. So obviously no hard feelings for you there if you were selling so many Hondas over the years. We talked about the honor flight and how that brought some things back around. I'm curious for you, have you ever looked at that photo in the Saturday Evening Post there? The photo of you on the deck of your battleship carrying this wounded Ranger on a stretcher and wondered if he survived? What happened to him?
Yes, I've wondered, and I don't know. Because after I took him down to the hospital area, I never saw him again, and so I really don't know what happened to him.
So he could be one of those more than 400,000 who are represented by those gold stars you talked about.
That's right. I know that he was not conscious when we were carrying him down. I tried to talk to him, and I couldn't get anything out of him. And he was one of those Rangers. They're the first ones in, you know. They were heroes, those people were. A lot of heroes in the war, but these men went in first, sneaked in, you know. Didn't even get noticed.
Well, and I know some of these questions aren't easy to answer, but I think, again, of your four kids, your six grandkids, and all the rest of us who weren't around during World War II, weren't around to see all the things that you saw. What do you think we need to remember about all those men that you served with and why you guys did what you did?
Well, you know, that war was a very personal war with the United States because we were attacked. We were helping in the European war before that with supplies and ammunition against Hitler. But when we got attacked on our own property, it became a very personal thing, I think. The feeling that we had was so much patriotism among the people, the general public, and the people that were involved, like myself. We just loved our country, and we just, I know that when we were in battle even, I'd think, you know, and we were taught to hate our enemy, and I hated the Japanese at that time. Some of my best friends are Japanese today.
What changed?
I think growing up and realizing that it wasn't the people that were doing this. It was the leaders that mm-hmm. were doing it. I know one of my friends, he's a very close friend, and he was in a concentration camp with a child with his folks. They took everything away. They were big farmers.
The Japanese internment here.
Japanese internment. And every once in a while, we'll talk about that. But I love the guy. He's just the sweetest man you'll ever meet. And I've met lots of Japanese people that they're just wonderful people. I had opportunity. I won a trip from Honda back to Japan, where I spent 10 days in Japan. I think that was in about 1988 or something like that.
All right.
I was impressed with the people in Japan. They're so neat and so clean, and they wash down their streets every night, everything. So polite. They bow to you and treat you like royalty. Beautiful people. They didn't want the war any more than we did.
No. And in the end, the war delivered them from a leadership that had taken them into that situation.
Right.
What keeps you going? 91 years old. Everyone can hear how sharp you are. I know you're still playing music. What is it that keeps you going?
Well, I am a happy man in the first place. I have a wonderful family and wonderful friends. I keep busy. I'm always doing something. I love to visit people that can't get out. I come away feeling real good, hoping they feel good too.
You ever play your violin for them?
A group in our church goes to every third Sunday. We go to Horizon Nursing Home, and we hold a little service at 2:00 in the afternoon, and I play my violin there.
You're still doing that?
I'm not doing it right now, but I'm going to start doing it again. That's why I got out my violin, and I'm starting to practice again.
Uh-huh.
I haven't played for quite a while. It's getting lazy, I guess.
I keep
busy and active, and I'll do that as long as I can.
Well, I hope that's a long, long time. And here's someone else who feels that way, Leon's son, Dan Christensen, who has gotten to do something that his dad hasn't, visit the USS Texas, where it's on display in Houston. You even saw that huge unexploded shell that could have claimed your dad's life. What was that like?
Actually, it was pretty emotional. I can remember driving in the parking lot that day, It was in the Houston Ship Channel. To see it in the conning tower that Dad had talked about so often, and to walk on board, it seemed like a live ship. You could still smell the oil, and I can remember a fellow who served on the Texas. He said, there's nothing like gun smoke and blood that brings men together. It was just like I was kind of reliving it. The 14-inch guns, the quad 40s, the 20 millimeters, and I'd seen pictures of the Texas in action. It was almost like a ghost ship. You could still see the sailors out there fighting. And like Dad talked about, the kamikaze airplanes. I embarrassed my wife at the time because I got on a quad 40 and I was pretending like I was shooting down Zeros. And you could still sit on them and you could still elevate the guns up and down. But I think the thing that impressed me the most was growing up in the 40s and 50s, and it seemed like television was pretty dominant in World War II movies. To know your dad when you were 7 years old fought in the Second World War. Of course, as we grow older, you learn to appreciate just exactly what these guys did for our country. You know, they'd come through a depression and all of a sudden found themselves thrust into one of the greatest conflicts known to man to this date, World War II. And to know that your father served in both theaters, a lot of his friends did. You'd made mention of the Kiwanis Club of East Fresno, and a lot of my friends had served in the Second World War and that also. And to be able to talk to these guys, and of course when you're little, they're your role model and your mentors. And I think for children that were born in my generation, we were very, very lucky to have that.
No question. And I can see how you feel about your dad. And for you, I don't want to be melodramatic. You mentioned being on that ship and almost feeling what it was like to be on that ship in World War II. But when you saw that unexploded bomb, did it hit you that you might not be here if that thing had gone off?
I'd heard the story so many times, and like I said, it was an emotional experience. I can remember I didn't have a cell phone. This was quite a few years ago. There was a volunteer on the ship, and I said, I'd like to use your telephone. I'd like to call my dad and tell him that I'm on his ship. He says, well, we don't ordinarily allow that. I said, well, my dad fought in four major battles on this ship.
Mm-hmm.
He's still alive, and I'd like to be able to tell him that I'm standing on it as we speak. So he allowed me to do that. And again, that was kind of emotional.
Probably tears on both ends of that one.
Well, actually, they had movies playing on the ship at the time, and they actually showed the battle. And the gentleman, Mr. Christensen, that was killed in that battle, showed his picture, showed the damage that was done to the conning tower, and to know that your dad was there, and now I'm there. It actually is the oldest remaining battleship still afloat, and I would recommend for anybody who's listening out there, if they ever get close to Houston, Texas, by all means, make the trip.
Well, I think they have an extra reason to do so after hearing your dad's story. Anything else you want to say about him?
You know, Dad's generation's commonly referred to as the greatest generation of our country. And because of men and women like my father and my mother that went through all that for us so we could have a future, pretty amazing.
Amen. And if we're going to get two generations, why not make it three? Leon's grandson, Daniel DeVoe, was his guardian on a Central Valley honor flight to Washington, D.C. I bet you saw a whole new side of your grandpa.
Well, that was what's crazy is, like, you know, growing up, he never really talked about his experience during the war. I think he's just pretty private about it. And, you know, which I, it was totally understandable. But during that experience, just being around the other vets, it definitely brought a lot out of him. You know, he was more comfortable, and he just started sharing stories, and it was like I wasn't even there. And it blew my mind, the stuff that they were all sharing together. And then ever since then, he's been a lot more open with me, and just every day I learned something new from him. I think that Iwo Jima was probably the most breathtaking experience that I remember from the trip. But I mean, every single memorial was incredible. You know, you can't put it into words. It was my first trip to DC, which was incredible because I got to be with my grandpa there. But yeah, every single war memorial was really cool. World War II memorial was awesome. You know, like how he was saying earlier about how each star represented, you know, a certain number of lost soldiers, and yeah, it was great.
So you'd recommend it for somebody else who's got a grandpa going?
Oh, huh? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No question.
And again, I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but if this is how your mind works, I think it's relevant to talk about. Is there any part of that experience where you say, you know, I would have never been born if he didn't come home from the war?
The whole time. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because the odds were, you know, I mean, if you look at all the soldiers that we lost during that time, I mean, it was stacked against them all. And there's just so many different, and like the story he was talking about how his mom, you know, prayed for him on that day. And if that had not happened, you know, I mean, it's just, it's a miracle, the whole situation. And, you know, everything worked out right.
Does it make you look at your own life a little differently?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I'm blessed to be here, and I'm blessed to have parents that I have and an uncle that I have and absolutely the grandpa that I have.
Anything else you want to say about him?
Just that I love him, and I'm glad he's here, and I'm glad I got to go with him on the honor flight, and he shared a story today, and it was incredible.
Hard to argue with that, and pretty neat to get perspective from three generations of a special family today. We're out of time, but don't forget to check out all those photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and sign up the veteran in your life for that free honor flight experience. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.